Hello, and welcome to episode 142 of SMARTS, which, as you know, stands for Speedster Makes Amusing Remarks to Shipmates.
Ooh.
Yes. Haha. I am your host, Julia Guglia of Internet fame, a Dash podcaster, and with me, as always, is Trevor, aka Rutiger Q Podcaster.
Hello.
Hi. Okay, intro over. How about some news?
Okay.
You said there was a lot this week.
There is a lot of news. So, in movie news, Kristen Wiig has been tapped by Patty Jenkins to play the villain in the Wonder Woman sequel. She will be playing Cheetah.
That's so cool.
All indications are that this is the Barbara Ann Minerva version of Cheetah, which is the modern version of Cheetah.
Yep.
Not any of the, I think there were two previous versions. I know the Golden Age Cheetah was Priscilla Rich, and she had a whole different backstory.
Yep.
The whole
rich heiress type cat
bride,
loving thing.
The whole cat bride of the Aztec god Urskatarga, you know, thing is the modern version. I think that's the version they're going with. I could picture her playing the version as written, you know, your only exposure. I mean, I guess you saw her in various cartoons and so on.
I was going to say that I know Priscilla Ridge's background,
No, Barbara Ann Minerva is the version that you know from the current comics.
I saw both. That's what I'm telling you.
Where did you see the
Priscilla Ridge was in one of the instances of a comic was when it was kind of thrown back in time for a little bit, like Bombshells. It wasn't the Bombshells issue that you read, because I don't read that, but it was some version of the Legion of Doom was getting together, and you see this woman in a cat suit, I mean, in a leopard print fur coat with her feet on a cross, drinking a glass of wine, and you're like, oh, that's Priscilla Rich. And I'm like, oh, it's another version of...
I don't remember.
And she was Cheetah without being like a full-on...
I believe you, but I don't remember what version that you would have been exposed to.
Cheetah.
Anyway. So yeah, I mean, I haven't had a lot of exposure to her. I watch Saturday Night Live sporadically. Not that she's on that anymore.
I love Kristen Wiig.
And I don't really watch a lot of comedies.
Kristen Wiig.
I met her. That's true. I don't watch a lot of comedies, and I never watched like the Ghostbusters reboot or
anything.
I'm
a big fan of hers. I didn't see the Ghostbusters reboot. I did see Saturday Night Live extensively.
She was good in what little I saw her on that.
Anyway, she was fantastic.
People seem to be generally happy about this.
And
anyway,
I saw Bridesmaids, which is a movie that she wrote and directed. Did she direct that? I think she did. But she was definitely in it. It was a really good movie, had a lot of heart in it, and I liked that one. So,
I saw someone say, this is apropos of nothing, but I saw someone say that they were disappointed in this casting. They think that she's great, but they thought that she would have made a better Veronica Kale than Cheetah. And I'm like, I could see her as...
I could see her as both.
That's a bit more... That's more on the nose. Like, I think that's more what you would kind of traditionally... Like, I could see her playing a cold, calculating businesswoman.
Yes.
But I think she can do this, too. But that would have been interesting. I wonder if they'll ever do... Maybe if they get to the modern day. Maybe if they do... Because this is rumored to be set sometime in between the 40s and the present day. Like, maybe the 70s or the 80s or something.
Interesting.
And maybe if they get to the present day now with, like, big business. I mean, maybe if this is set... Say this is set in the 60s or 70s, and then they do one set in the late 80s, early 90s, when you've got the whole, like, greed is good, Wall Street boom thing.
Sure.
Then there would be a cool idea to have, like, a tech, like a Steve Jobs type, but have it be a woman.
A woman,
do the Veronica Kale thing then, when the whole... With the whole, you know, the whole big business...
I think
Michael
that
Douglas Wall Street kind of vibe.
To be perfectly honest with you, I love the complexity of both of these villains, but I think playing a Veronica Kale is less interesting than playing Barbara Minerva. That's just...
I
don't know. I think you need a
villain, much like, you know, you could do Lex Luthor in a Superman movie, but eventually most Superman stories that have Lex Luthor in them usually have also like a more physical threat for him to fight.
Yep.
And Lex Luthor is just the one pulling the strings. And so I think especially for a movie, Veronica Kale makes a great villain for a longer run where her motives are slowly teased out and she can slowly manipulate events to her will and so on like that. But for like a 2-hour action spectacle, I think that Cheetah is a better bet. Maybe they'll have, you know, not to say that they couldn't introduce her here and have, like, I'm just speculating that they might do Veronica Kale eventually. And now we're not even talking about Kristen Wiig anymore, but Veronica Kale is an awesome character. If they were to introduce her and then develop her over the course of one or two movies until she becomes the big villain, because oftentimes she's introduced and she's more sympathetic at first until events conspire against her and sort of she and Wonder Woman end up on opposite sides. Anyway, so I mean, most of all, I'm just happy that the movie is moving forward.
DC
hasn't done something to like alienate Patty Jenkins and fire her from the movie. Like, they keep losing all their other directors. I just hope they hold on to her, you know?
Yeah, right.
Don't let her go anywhere.
Yeah. I was surprised to hear this news because I did not know that Kristen Wiig was interested in taking on a dramatic role or even... I mean, being in a comic book movie is one thing, but being... I don't know. This is a really tough role, you know? Because you're not being bombastic and cartoony for a Patty Jenkins movie.
I think she's also,
you know, you're being a real human, conflicted.
I think if people were to imagine people were to like fan cast Cheetah, they would have imagined a younger actress too. Not that Kristen Wiig is old, but I think they would have imagined someone more in like their early 20s, like a real physical threat, you know, like a big, like a tall woman, strong.
Who would you pick?
Well, I mean, someone like
Jerry Ryan in her prime.
Well, no, or someone like Gal Gadot, right? Like who's an imposing physical presence, especially when she beefs up for the role. Kristen Wiig is older and slighter than you would imagine for a purely physical threat, you know, mm-hmm. which is perhaps the other reason why people would imagine her as more of a Veronica Kale type.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not like when they cast, you know, Ben Affleck as Batman, for example. He's older than Batman traditionally is, but it's like, oh yeah, Ben Affleck is like a huge guy.
Nobody thought that Chris Pratt could trim down to be Star-Lord, you know, like at first he showed up to the audition and he said, look at this, like, pay no attention to the 35 extra pounds of me because I will trim down. Now let me show you what I remember, one fan casting for
Cheetah years ago, people were saying Marina Baccarin would make a great Cheetah.
Oh, that's a good call. Because
she has that sort of exotic look about her
and also bit sort of cat-like statuesque. As well.
Also, there's like this, which is funny because she actually voiced Cheetah in Batman the Brave and the Bold in a couple of appearances there. Anyway,
fan casting. I'm glad they cast Kristen Wiig. I'm excited to see what she'll do with it.
I actually
saw her on an episode with Jerry Seinfeld's new show on Netflix. It's comedians riding in cars, getting coffee or something. I think I screwed up the title a little bit, but and she's actually a really shy person in real life. Like, she likes to do the acting. She likes to be anybody but herself. But in terms of like standing in front of crowds and saying, "Hey, look at me! I'm so fantastic." That's so against her personality. She just enjoys tackling roles, which is I don't know. It was just nice to hear her on that interview.
You know what it actually reminds me of is the casting of Michael Keaton for Batman back in the day. People were like, he's too short, he's a comedian, he's too old, he's not physically imposing, and he killed it. Like, his performance is still controversial because some people still want to see those things in Batman. They don't, you know, like, no matter how well he did, people would be like, they just couldn't get past the fact that he doesn't look like Batman,
which is true.
He doesn't look like the traditional version of Batman. But if you're able to get past that, it was a great performance.
Oh my God, yeah.
So I think that this, it kind of reminds me of that, because all people say, what, Mr. Mom is Batman? Like, nobody could, you know.
Yeah, that's true.
Anyway, so in other news, so we talked a while ago about how Disney is gearing up to do multiple new series in the Star Wars and Marvel realms for their new streaming service, which is launching next year, right? So the first Star Wars live action series will be featured on this new Disney streaming service, and there'll be new Marvel shows and stuff to go with that. Now we have the first details on what this live-action Star Wars show will be, or at least who's going to be working on it. So
Dave Filoni?
Marvel has tapped... No, he's staying in the animation. So Marvel has tapped Jon Favreau, actor, director of Iron Man 1 and 2, and perhaps more germane to this, Disney's The Jungle Book live-action version.
It was tremendous.
And the upcoming Lion King live-action version. He's directing that also. So he's one of Disney's current golden boys. They've tapped him to write and executive produce the new live-action Star Wars TV series.
That's so cool.
So its details are scarce right now. It remains to be seen whether he'll be the day-to-day showrunner of the show or whether he will just set up the initial premise, write and perhaps direct the pilot.
And then kick the ball to somebody
else. Like J.J. Abrams for Lost and Fringe, for example, where he came in with the original idea, developed the idea, helped write the pilot, directed the pilot, and then was involved in sort of a very hands-off direction from then on. So it remains to be seen how involved he'll be day-to-day. But this is the first indication we have of any kind of what shape this new series will be taking. Apparently Jon Favreau is, you know... Because the Iron Man 1 was obviously a huge success, but that predates Marvel's acquisition by Disney. Obviously, they're aware
of
it.
True,
but I think more germane is the fact they keep handing him these huge blockbuster adaptations of their cartoon classics, and he seems to be doing a good job with them. So
did he do Beauty and the Beast? Because that was also good.
He didn't do that one. He did The Jungle Book, and now he's doing The Lion King.
Yeah, I loved The Jungle Book. Oh, tremendous, tremendous. Anyway.
So
that's awesome.
I mean, news will continue to come out for this, but and we don't need to get down this whole rabbit hole, but the blowback I've seen on this is that, much like with giving Rian Johnson a new trilogy, giving Episode 9 to J.J. Abrams, and giving the two Game of Thrones guys a new series of movies, this is another middle-aged white guy being handed the keys to Star Wars. And in an era where we have Patty Jenkins directing Wonder Woman, Ryan Coogler directing Black Panther, it's getting a little old to say, okay, here's another
now, white dude.
Disney has pledged that they're aware of this. They're taking steps to rectify it. It's just that all of the announcements they've made so far don't reflect the moves they're making behind the scenes to diversify the Star Wars creative lineup. We're only seeing the certain public facing announcements that they've made. It could be that, you know, for example, take this as an example, Jon Favreau might set up the pilot, but the day-to-day showrunners, much like how Joss Whedon mm-hmm. wrote and directed the first episode of Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., and then Marissa Tankerone and Jed Whedon run the show on a day-to-day basis. It could be something similar. So whoever comes in to run the show after him, the people that are working with them, you know, whoever else is involved in this show and other future shows could well be more diverse. But this is, you know...
I think that that's all well and good, but just because some people of color work in the mailroom or on the writing staff, it's not the same thing as seeing a diverse person in a leadership role.
Yeah, I understand.
Like, there's directors, and all of them are white dudes, and then the people that work for them may be people of color, maybe more women, maybe more diverse, but the critics out there, maybe even rightly so, can criticize that, yeah, but the top dog things still seem to be going to white
middle-aged white dudes. Yeah, it is more important to do that. I mean, I bet a lot of people know that J.J. Abrams developed Lost, but I think fewer people probably know the names of the people who worked on it on a daily basis. Yeah. And I'm forgetting them. I know it generally, but for some reason I'm blanking on it right now. Or people might know that Joss Whedon developed Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. because it says executive producer Joss Whedon. Now, it also says executive producers Marissa Tankerone and mm-hmm. Jed Whedon, but people are like, Marissa what? I don't know
Marissa,
who that is.
Who now? Yeah.
They don't know that there's an Asian woman running mm-hmm. Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D.
That's true.
On a daily basis. Yep. Like, I bet a lot of people don't know that unless they read interviews or watch the behind-the-scenes stuff, because she's not...
I was actually surprised to learn that, and that's from an interview that you read and sent to me, and I was like, oh, that's interesting. That's
so
good.
Yeah, I mean, it's yeah, Carlton Cuse right. is one of the guys on Lost, but that's not the main one. But anyway,
you're right.
So yeah, it's important to have that out there. I mean, yeah, like everybody that worked on, I know this isn't true, but say for example, everybody else that worked behind the scenes on Black Panther could have been white,
right?
And but it's the fact that Ryan Coogler, a black director, directed it, is
exactly.
what's getting all the press.
This is exactly
so.
What I'm
sure
saying.
That there were a lot of minorities working on that movie behind the scenes. Certainly in front of the camera, there mm-hmm. there were a ton, but. What people notice is the big name that goes up in lights at the beginning and not necessarily,
exactly.
you know,
and that's, and
story editor or whatever. Like, I pay attention to that. I pay attention to who's like the story editor on these shows,
sure.
but most people don't. So
it's true.
Anyway, I mean, I like Jon Favreau. I like him as an actor. I like him as I loved Iron Man 1.
Mm-hmm.
I haven't seen these more recent Disney adaptations, but apparently they've been doing well.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's going to be a good product. But again, not to bog every story. We could bang this drum with just about every story. It's like, oh, Kristen Wiig was cast as Cheetah. Well, why not cast a black woman? Like,
well,
you know what
I mean? Yeah, exactly.
You know, you could do this every time. It deserves to be said. But anyway, it's neither here nor there. So the main publishing news this week is that in addition to, so DC is really diversifying their lineup recently. So they've got the Young Animal line
mm-hmm.
that's been around for a while. They're relaunching that. You know, they're in the process of relaunching that with, mm-hmm. with new number ones and some new titles. We talked a while ago about how they've got this New Age of Heroes line, right, with the Terrifics and Damage and Sideways and the Silencer and a bunch of new ones coming. Those have all been great so far.
Yep.
Right? We talked about how, what was the other one we talked recently? Oh, yeah, Bendis. About how Brian Michael Bendis is going to have his own little pop-up imprint within DC, too, where he gets to tackle characters that he's really keen on in addition to writing Superman and Action Comics.
Yep.
Well, DC has just announced another new imprint. This is more of a, and this, of course, is in addition to also having Vertigo, which mm-hmm. is continuing on. They got this new Sandman universe line within Vertigo that Neil Gaiman's going to be running, which we talked about last time. They've just announced another new imprint called mm-hmm. Black Label.
Mm-hmm.
This is, I guess you could say, a sort of a more prestigious boutique line of out-of-continuity books, finite projects. This is where they envision future projects that feature DC characters but are not in continuity and are what they hope to be, like, say, evergreen books like Watchmen or Dark Knight Returns, where they keep selling, you know, because they're not beholden to what's currently going on in the comics and the vagaries of the current continuity, you
mm-hmm.
know?
Yeah.
So this is where they're going to get top-tier creators telling their own, giving their own unique take on certain characters, maybe doing stories set in a possible future or revised origins or Elseworlds books, for lack of a better term, but under this new umbrella. They say also different formats will be involved. So you might see certain books, of course, we read everything digitally, but you might see certain books which are larger in size or what they call widescreen comics, where the book is oriented horizontally as opposed to vertically. They see this as a place of experimenting with the form in addition to bringing top tier creators.
That's cool.
So they've got a press release where they talk about the first books that they announced as being part of this, some of which were known previously, some of which we even talked about on the show, but now we know that this is going to be the home for those projects. And there's also new projects we didn't know about. So I'll just read you literally verbatim from the press release here. So the first project, which is probably the headlining one, Superman Year One from Frank Miller, Dark Knight Returns, Batman The Dark Knight Master Race, and John Romita Jr., All-Star Batman, Superman. A groundbreaking definitive treatment of Superman's classic origin story in honor of his 80th anniversary. The story details new revelations that reframe the Man of Steel's most famous milestones, from Kal-El's frantic exile from Krypton to Clark Kent's childhood in Kansas, to his inevitable rise to become the most powerful and inspiring superhero of all time. Oh, so this is basically Frank Miller doing for Superman what he did in Batman Year One 30 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
So, thankfully, out of continuity, because I don't think they need to change Superman's history officially again and reboot everything.
Yes,
I'm thankful they're not doing that, so I'm glad this is out of continuity. Here's another project that we talked about previously that's finding its home here. So we talked about Scott Snyder, All-Star Batman ended. He said he had one final Batman story.
Mm-hmm.
We even talked about the premise, about how he'd introduced this idea that Batman had set up like this cloning program where if he were to die, a new clone would be created of him that would have all the memories up to the point where he became Batman.
Yeah.
So Batman would always be like eternally 21 and perfect, you know, going into the future. So this is where this project is going to find a home. So called Batman Last Night on Earth, night, of course, spelt with a K, from Scott Snyder and Greg Capullo, the creative team behind Dark Knight's Metal. It says, Batman wakes up in a desert. He doesn't know what year it is or how the Joker's head is alive in a jar beside him, but it's the beginning of a quest unlike anything the Dark Knight has undertaken before. In this strange future, villains are triumphant and society has liberated itself from the burden of ethical codes. Fighting to survive while in search of answers, Bruce Wayne uncovers the truth about his role in this new world and begins the last Batman story ever told.
Whoa, boy.
Then there's Batman Damned from Brian Azzarello and Lee Bermejo, the creative team.
Is this also out of continuity?
All of these are.
Okay.
Now, I suppose you could reach a place
Brian
where...
Brian Azzarello did one, but it was in continuity. So I was,
right, well, all these creators. Sure. I mean, Scott Snyder's doing Dark Knight's Metal. That's in continuity. I suppose that you could get a scenario, which has happened before, where a story that was conceived as Elseworlds proves to be so definitive that it becomes in continuity. That's kind of what happened with Kingdom Come, where Kingdom Come was popular that for about 20 years there, it was unofficially, yet officially viewed as the definitive future of the DC universe. Every time they would introduce a new character or have a character get a costume that's the one they wore in Kingdom Come, people were like, oh, we're getting closer to Kingdom Come, you know. Anyway, Batman Damned from Brian Azzarello and Lee Bermejo, the creative team behind Joker. On a deserted Gotham City bridge, a body is found. Whispers spread the news. Joker is dead. But is this a dream come true, or a nightmare being born? Now Batman and DC's outlaw magician John Constantine must hunt the truth through a Gotham City hellscape. The city's supernatural recesses are laced with hints about a killer's identity, but the Dark Knight's descent into horror will test his sanity and the limits of rationality, as he must face a horror that doesn't wear a mask.
Wow.
Then there's Wonder Woman Historia, The Amazons, from Kelly Sue DeConnick and Phil Jimenez. So this is, Phil Jimenez has done a ton of art for DC. Kelly Sue DeConnick is a prominent female writer who's never worked for DC before.
Oh, cool.
She's done a lot of independent stuff. She's done a lot of Marvel stuff. So it says, a Homeric epic of the lost history of the Amazons and Queen Hippolyta's rise to power.
Hmm.
Featuring monsters and myths, this three-book saga spans history from the creation of the Amazons to the moment Steve Trevor washes up on the shores of Paradise Island, changing our world forever.
Hmm.
Then this next one is one of the ones I'm looking forward to most. Wonder Woman Diana's Daughter, working title, from Greg Rucka, Wonder Woman. It's no artist attached to this yet, but this is Greg Rucka coming back to Wonder Woman after he left it about a year ago.
Awesome.
It's been 20 years since the world stopped looking to the skies for hope, help, and inspiration. Now the world keeps its eyes down, and the powers that have risen have every intention of keeping things that way. Amongst a scattered, broken resistance, a young woman seeks to reclaim what has been forgotten, and on the way will learn the truth about herself, her heritage, and her destiny.
Ooh.
So this sounds kind of like a Batman Beyond, but for Wonder Woman kind of thing.
That's
but
awesome.
Greg Rucka is attached, so that's all I need to know.
Yep.
Here's another thing we talked about previously, but now we know it's going to be a part of this. The Other History of the DC Universe from John Ridley, 12 Years a Slave and the American Way. Right?
Oh,
we talked about this.
Mm-hmm.
A compelling literary series analyzing iconic DC moments and charting sociopolitical gains through the perspectives of DC superheroes who come from traditionally disenfranchised groups, including Jon Stewart, Extraño, Vixen, Supergirl, Katana, and Renee Montoya, among others. At its core, the story focuses on the lives of those behind the costumes and their endeavors to overcome real-world issues. It isn't about saving the world, it's about having the strength to simply be who you are. So we talked about this before, about how before we knew it was going to be out of continuity, we're like, so will this... Because a lot of these characters were created in times that make their sociopolitical, their very existence more sociopolitically relevant. Like the fact that Jon Stewart was introduced in the 70s is important to why that character is important. So if it were to be in continuity and Jon Stewart became Green Lantern in like 2011 or something, some vague 5 or 6 years ago, his importance is less obvious when viewed from this lens. So it actually makes sense that this would be out of continuity because now they can tell it in like real time and show, you know, when Vixen was and Jon Stewart were introduced in the 70s, when Renee Montoya came out in the 90s, why that was important, stuff like that, you know. So anyway, those are the initial projects they're announcing. So these are all-star creators. I mean, John Ridley, didn't he win an Oscar for 12 Years a Slave? And of course, Scott Snyder, Brian Azzarello, Frank Miller, Greg Rucka. I mean, I focus tend to focus more on the writers than the artists. And I think
these are the creme de la creme.
These are pretty awesome artists, too. You know, Greg Capullo,
no,
John Romita Jr.,
I'm such
Phil
a fan
Jimenez.
Of Phil Jimenez. I actually know his name.
Yeah, Phil Jimenez. I think the only thing you've seen him do, he did portions of the DC Universe Rebirth one-shot that kicked off the whole Rebirth thing, you know, where Wally West came back. He did that awesome sequence at the end where Wally comes out of the Speed Force and hugs Barry. Like,
yes,
that's
I do
recent
remember
page.
That.
He also wrote the first year or so of the recent Superwoman series and did the art on the first few issues of that also.
Yep.
You would recognize the style if you saw it. It's very, very detailed, very, very busy in a way. Like, he packs a lot into every page.
Yes.
Did he what?
Did he also do, who did Super Sons? Because I remember
Oh, you're thinking of Jorge Jimenez. There's actually a bunch. There's actually at least three or four Jimenezes working in comics now that
so
I can
funny.
Think of. There's also an Oscar Jimenez, although I haven't seen his name on something in a long time. Okay. Anyway, so that's the Black Label imprint. So I think we're going to see the first books from this label maybe later this year, near the end of this year, but these are going to, you know, continue coming out on a rolling basis. So again, they want to tinker with format also. So some of these might be 6-issue miniseries, regular-sized issues coming out monthly. Some of these might take the form of, like, thick bi-monthly issues, like, say, the recent Deadman romance miniseries was, where it was, like, you know, 60 pages every 2 months, for example. Mm-hmm. Some of them might be graphic novels, 90, 120 pages that come out every year if it's continuing, or might some of them might even be, like, a single graphic novel, you know, like 200 pages that comes out once and that's the whole story. We don't know. So the publishing styles of these, you know, will probably vary much as the, apparently the size of the issues might also vary. Like I said, you know, they might do something different with the physical format. So this is sort of an all-star lineup of, I mean, they've had, what was it? They had All-Star Superman, obviously All-Star Batman. DC has at times had like a boutique brand. I keep coming back to that word, but I don't know what else to call it, where their top creators who have really proved themselves get to work on, I mean, perhaps less charitable term for it might be vanity projects, you know, where they get, you've proven that you're a huge seller and everything you write makes us millions of dollars. Go tell whatever kind of Superman story you want. If you want to tell a story about Superman, you know, that's where those kinds of projects go for people who have earned their stripes or either in comics or in another industry, you know, like John Ridley has, to come and tell stories that are very personal to them and a story that they want to tell that wouldn't really fit in the regular continuity.
Yeah.
So I'm looking forward to this.
That's
this is just
super
another,
exciting.
And there's even, and this is why you see people like with Bendis coming to DC and other writers that have been writing for DC for years saying that they've never seen the company this energized before. That in addition to just telling awesome stories in their regular titles, that they're taking a lot of gambles with format, with creators that have never worked with them before, like Bendis, who've practically synonymous with Marvel for the past 20 years. New formats, you know, and then there's this DC streaming service coming out soon. And we talked back when that was first announced that I wouldn't be surprised to see some sort of new digital publishing initiative, maybe the equivalent of what Marvel Unlimited is, but for DC, where if you subscribe to the streaming service, you also get all the monthly comics, you know, as part of your subscription. Like, I wouldn't be surprised to see them taking increasingly crazy chances and risks with all sorts of new ideas here. It seems like the company is really, it seems like the success of the Rebirth line as a publishing initiative really buoyed their spirits.
Yep.
And of course, they're continuing to see huge success.
You say buoyed?
Buoyed.
Buoyed?
Well, I think you can pronounce it either way. And of course, they're continuing to have huge success in TV. It's really only the movie area where it's been a little hit and miss critically and commercially. But even there, I think the success of Wonder Woman has done a lot for their morale
definitely.
Also. So anyway, so it's exciting. The only other, only one other comic thing this week is that Gail Simone, who's a writer that I have a lot of affection for, it was announced that she's writing a new Plastic Man miniseries. So this is a character I think is right up her alley. Apparently it's one of
right
her favorites.
Right up my alley, too.
I'm not sure she's ever written Plastic Man before, but he might have had like some
one-off. They usually give her a lot of girl characters to write for, don't they?
Well, it's because that's what she gravitates to most, I think. Okay. I mean, she made her bones on a really long, fantastic run on Birds of Prey. I mean, Birds of Prey is a thing that you've heard of because Gail Simone took a title that was... She didn't create the idea, but she took a title that was like probably the lowest selling, least interesting Batman family title.
Was this before or after it was a crappy WB show?
I think it became a WB show on because she had turned the comic into something that was popular and recognizable. They just chose to change everything about it when they did the WB show.
Big mistake. Yeah,
but Birds of Prey, and then she did a great run on Wonder Woman that was unfortunately cut short. She did a great run on Superman that was cut short. Secret Six is her other... I mean, she's done a lot of creator-owned stuff recently.
Mm-hmm.
She did Secret Six, which is a group of sort of outcast villains who just happened to form a loose... association. So you had Vandal Savage's daughter, you had Deadshot, you had a parademon from Apocalypse, Ragdoll. Who else was on Secret Six? Bane was there eventually. The Mad Hatter was there for a while. It was like this weird eclectic group of villains who became like this little found family and support each other, but you always knew that any one of them could betray any of the others at any given time, but she always managed to walk that line really well. Anyway, she's great, but she has her style of storytelling is it definitely tends to have a lot of humor in it, but also a lot of pathos. So I think that Plastic Man's a really good fit for her. She's apparently always wanted to work with the character. So this will be a mini series. It will presumably be in continuity, but it's not directly related to the character's appearance over in The Terrifics.
Mm-hmm.
So it won't contradict anything there, but don't expect to see, you know, his pals from The Terrifics show up here. It's, you know, just a separate story about the same character. But I'm looking forward to that too. That's it for news.
Wow, that's a great batch of news.
So should we talk about our comics of the week?
Yes, ready.
So what was your comic of the week?
So my comic of the week this week was my favorite guilty pleasure, Bane. This week's issue was number 10. The only reason I picked it is because it's just comfort food at this point. It's a lot of fun to watch Bane try to solve this puzzle, chase down the leader of the Naha Naha, which is, or Naja Naja, or Naya Naya, or however you want to pronounce it. The Cobra leader, the Cobra cult leader, happens to be an infant being taken care of by the interim leader, I suppose, slash caretaker, slash guardian, slash mother figure, slash badass warrior lady who is in charge of the rest of the Cobra units, and they want to kill Bane. Bane wants to kidnap the child, but not kill him, because that would defeat the purpose of controlling the Cobra cult in the first place, because they believe that the soul incarnation resides within this little infant, and so if the child dies, then the infant gets reborn into somebody else, and the whole shebang would start all over again. So Bane can't kill this child, which is nice, because, you know, child death is not funny at all. At the same time, Bane is trying to catch all them. Batman is lurking in the wings, and so seeing all of that mashed up together, and seeing cute little pictures of the infant sitting in the chair and napping while the lady is slamming her fists on a table and saying, "The Naha Naha is displeased," and I'm like, he looks pretty pleased to me. He looks like he's just had a nap, and I mean, had a big meal and is settled down for a cute nap, and I'm just laughing all the way. So I don't know, it's just pure enjoyment, and I look forward to reading this every single time we have these issues. So it's my comic of the week. What about you? What'd you pick?
I picked Green Arrow number 38, which is Benjamin Percy's final issue. I believe it's obviously the finale of this big arc that he's been telling for 38 issues. I believe also his final issue. I guess it's possible he might have like a one-off epilogue issue, but I think it's his final issue. He's moving over to Nightwing, apparently. He's right. I think he's staying on Teen Titans, but I could be wrong about that. At any rate, this run has been great. I think Green Arrow, probably out of 38 issues, I don't know how many have been one of our comics of the week. I would imagine at least 8, 10, 12
definitely.
Probably have been our comics of the week.
Yeah.
It's always been consistently,
tremendous.
Some of the best stuff.
I don't even want to say it's good. Good is an understatement.
But I think it's remarkable how, one thing that he did that I noticed, although I had to really think about the meaning, the final shot is a full page, a full splash page close-up of Green Arrow grinning and holding like an arrow up to the camera and so on. It is a variation on the cover of issue number 1, where he was in a similar pose, but looking very stoic and grim.
Yeah.
And what that is there to, you know, if you put your, you know, literary thinking analysis cap hat on for a second, that was to show that he took a character which was not really the Oliver Queen that we know historically. He was, you know, he
the
was
jovial
young,
type person.
He was young, clean shaven, yeah, you know, Steve Jobs tech genius who was really arrogant. I mean, he had the arrogance in common.
Sure.
But when you think of Green Arrow, you think of like lighthearted yet really driven,
bleeding heart liberal,
arrogant but knows it, you know,
yeah,
has
full of himself but kind
of deeply flawed, yeah, but also socially and personally and emotionally available enough to know about his own flaws,
yeah, self-aware,
always getting in his own way, you know,
but don't forget but, the bleeding heart liberal,
yeah,
part.
Bleeding heart liberal, but you know, you got to have the Van Dyke, oh, yeah, goatee, you've got absolutely to have the hood, you've got to have, you know, Black Canary, Black Canary should be in there, like sure, there's certain things that, you know,
makes a Oliver Queen pie.
Right, and he didn't have any, recipe. I mean, he was arrogant, he was rich, he had the bow and the arrow, he had a supporting cast which was interesting, like Henry V and Emiko and a few other characters like that. They'd recently reintroduced John Diggle, or I should say introduced, I suppose, because he was a character creator,
yeah,
for the TV
right
show.
Mm-hmm.
But it was, the stories were good. I remember particularly Jeff Lemire's run was good. That was really the only bright spot since the New 52, in my opinion, but it wasn't, they were good stories at times, but they didn't really seem like classical Green Arrow storylines. Mm-hmm. Like, there wasn't a lot there that was definitively Green Arrow.
Sure.
And so, much like with the whole Rebirth initiative, it was Percy's job to bring a lot of that back. So, immediately you got the beard.
Yep.
You got a lighter attitude.
Wasn't it in the first issue that he shaved and he said, I'm just trying
right
out this look?
You got Black Canary in there. And sure, you could nitpick and say that they were madly in love with each other, star-crossed romance, you know, an eternal love within mere issues.
Sure.
Just because we, the audience, know that they're destined to be together.
Yeah.
You know, you could nitpick with stuff like that, but I feel like
you can't please everybody.
In just a couple of years worth of comics, he made Seattle/Star City a very, you know, recognizable place with interesting things that set it apart from the other DC cities.
Yep.
He introduced the whole concept of this Ninth Circle cult/bank for villains. You know, reintroduced Malcolm Merlyn, surprisingly brought Moira Queen in as a villainess.
Yeah,
he gives his villainous mayor character, reintroduced other characters as villains like Brick and Eddie Fires, brought in Shadow, gave her some interesting stuff to do.
A bigger story arc in terms of the threat than just being in Star City. Like,
right,
it went across the
country.
Right,
and I'm getting to that too, but also they brought in, you know, continued key. And the other thing, he didn't throw out what worked. So he kept the Emiko character, which was recently introduced in the comics, but sort of leveled her up and made her into Red Arrow,
yeah,
which also involved bringing in Roy Harper and having reintroducing him into the Arrow family, because he'd been off on his own thing. Since the New 52, he'd barely even interacted with Green Arrow. They were never even really partners in history. So he threw all that out and said, no, of course, they were Green Arrow and Speedy, and they were partners. And then he became Red Arrow again, which was also not in continuity anymore. And then Emiko becomes Red Arrow. But by having him travel, doing the whole hard traveling hero thing, which of course is a nod to the whole
trip,
Green Lantern,
yep,
Green Arrow, hard traveling heroes thing from the 70s, Denny O'Neill, Neil Adams, had him travel across the country and interact with a different Justice League member in every issue and sort of earn his stripes in their eyes.
Right.
He elevated Green Arrow to like a Justice League level character again, which of course he'd been for a long time since he was the first new member of the Justice League that was inducted after the original seven. So he'd been a member of the Justice League off and on for like 40, 50 years in the comics, but ever since the New 52, much like a lot of the problems with the New 52 stem from the fact that the characters seemed like they were off on their own weird island.
Yep.
They lost a lot of their past history. They lost a lot of the relationships with other characters, and a lot of that was what made them, like, part of what makes Green Arrow Green Arrow is, you know, having Roy Harper there as Speedy or as an ex-sidekick,
right,
having Black Canary be either his current or ex-girlfriend, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like having Hal Jordan be his best pal that they went on adventures together, right?
Right.
Being the guy that the Justice League thinks of as a bit of a loose cannon, but still has immense respect for him.
Yep.
So Percy had to reintroduce all that. And so what you're left with at the end, and they had this nice sequence where he's opening up like a children's shelter and calling it like the Dinah Lance or whatever.
Yeah.
Because she was an orphan and all this other stuff.
And she had a crappy childhood.
That great spread was there alongside all the other Justice League members, showing Emiko and Diggle and Henry V. And I'm surprised they didn't bring Roy in for the final arc too, but he's been there off and on. So we know that they're on good terms again.
Yep.
And then having that final page, like I said, which mirrors the first cover where he's all, but here he is with this big grin on his face.
Yeah.
And he's like, One of the things that's great about Green Arrow that I feel like even the TV show has gradually gotten to is despite all the hardships and all the losses and the fact that being Green Arrow often in many versions will cost him his company mm-hmm. and his money and his mm-hmm. family and all this other stuff, he still loves being Green Arrow, you know?
Yeah.
And I feel like
he still sees the glass half full.
Right. Well, but he loves it. Like he enjoys, I mean, both in good ways and bad ways. Like he loves putting arrows in people he thinks deserves it. Like yeah. he's
true.
And he's very honest about it.
He super does.
He just loves making, you know, making
bad guys pay.
Like, yeah, if someone's
sure.
It doesn't matter if they're corporate fat cats or bank robbers or what they are. Mm-hmm. Like if he thinks you deserve it, he'll put an arrow in you and he won't kill you, but you know, he'll maim you and he'll still, you know,
yeah,
go off with a laugh and a smile because yeah. he thinks you deserve it. Like he's got that arrogant, you know, he even says in this issue,
he's a swashbuckler.
He even says in this issue, and it's, you know, a trigger word these days for whatever reason that I've never fully understood, but he even in this issue says, like, I'm proud to be a social justice warrior,
yeah.
right?
Yeah.
Like, I mean, that's his 2018 liberal
yep.
activist as you can get, and he wears yep. those kinds of labels proudly because he
sure
enjoys
does.
Kicking off people that are triggered,
are opposed to
right?
That
are opposed to that kind
that,
of
yeah.
terminology, you know?
If you're bothered by it, you're exactly the type of person who
anyway,
who
so I mean,
trolling.
I consistently enjoyed the series. The art, of course, the art in this issue by Juan Ferreira was phenomenal. It's been generally yeah. Juan Ferreira and Otto Schmidt rotating back and forth with some other artists in there, but the art has been consistently phenomenal and also really artistically deep in a way that a lot of comic book superhero art is enjoyable and serviceable and fits mm-hmm. the story, but doesn't necessarily make you sit back and appreciate it as art a lot of times. This series did. So I think this has been a fantastic run. I'm looking forward to what he's doing on Nightwing. I've been enjoying his Teen Titans run too. It hasn't been as exceptional to me, but I think that he's been doing good stuff over there too.
Yeah.
But I think that this is one of the really great Green Arrow runs from like the last 20 or 30 years. I think you've got Kevin Smith's run was great. Brad Meltzer did some great stuff. Judd Winnick did some okay stuff, and then you had Jeff Lemire about 5 or 6 years ago, and then this. Like, Green Arrow runs tend to be good every 5 years or so, and mm-hmm. then you enter, like, a fallow period.
Aww.
I feel like Wonder Woman has
good
been that
luck,
way.
Good luck, whoever comes next.
Well, Wonder Woman, Aquaman, even Flash to a certain degree. Like, unlike Superman and Batman, where DC tends to put their top talent on there, whoever yeah. their top talent is at the time, other, like, B-level characters, even Green Lantern to a certain degree, like, they'll have these bright spots, and then there'll be a few years where it's like things aren't really clicking,
mm-hmm.
and then they'll be like, bang, and there'll be another run that reminds you why you love that character.
Yeah.
I hope that this won't... I forget who's coming on after him. I think this is another one of these situations where there's some good writers coming on after him, but I think it reads to me like they've got some fill-in stuff coming.
Mm-hmm.
Like when they had a short fill-in run on Wonder Woman before the current run by James... After Greg Rucka left, they had like a 6-issue run
mm-hmm.
by... a person whose name I've already forgotten until the current writer James Robinson started.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like there's going to be like a short bridge here before the next big writer comes on board. So mm-hmm. the stories, you know, hopefully will be good, but I think that we'll have to see where it goes from here. But I really enjoyed it. And so I'm sad to see it end.
Same here. I consistently would take a longer time to read it too, because I would be enchanted by the art as well as how perfectly it seemed to fit with the story. And the stories were always fantastic. So I 100% agree. Good choice.
Should we do your pop quiz?
Yeah, I'm ready.
Okay, so because we just finished watching season 5 of Star Trek Deep Space Nine,
okay,
I'm going to quiz you about Deep Space Nine recurring characters.
Oh, boy. Okay.
Actually, I think some of these are probably pretty easy, comparatively speaking.
Okay, All right. I hope so.
So number one,
uh-huh.
How does Jeffrey Combs' Ferengi character always introduce himself?
Brett, FCA.
Well, it's Brunt, not Brett.
Brunt.
Brett is like a bro surfer dude. Brand.
I know, but the way he like folds his mouth over those teeth.
You try enunciating with all those prosthetics.
I know. It's just Brunt, FCA. Yeah.
All right. Number two.
Uh-huh.
What classic, this one is such a gimme. What classic novel does Michael Eddington equate to his relationship with Sisko?
Oh, is it Hugo? I'm kidding. Jean Valjean.
It's funny.
Les Miserables.
There you go.
Sorry. No, it took me a while to dig up the, yeah.
All right. Number three.
Yes.
What phobia? Where did I get that from? What phobia does Garak suffer from?
Oh, claustrophobia.
That's right. Number four.
Uh-huh.
What do Quark and Rom call their mother?
Moogie.
That's right. Number five. Uh-huh. What Klingon general is replaced with a changeling and starts a war with Cardassia?
Martok.
Correct.
Yay!
Number six.
Uh-huh.
What Bajoran scientist discovered and raised Odo?
Oh.
This is his last name will do. Like everyone always calls him Dr. Blank.
Yeah, Dr. I can't. I hear his name and I recognize it and I know who they're talking about, but No, I don't know. Dr. Borda, Morda, something like
Dr.
that.
Dr. Boredom.
I don't know. I can't do it.
Dr. Mora.
Mora. See? Oh, see, the shape of the sound was right. Right. Okay.
Number seven.
Dyslexia sucks, everybody. Yes.
Number seven.
Yes.
What two occupations have we seen Keiko O'Brien perform?
Teacher and, botanist, for lack of better
word.
Well,
that is the word. That's what her degree is in. No, you're right. That's what I was looking for. All right. Number eight. Mm-hmm. What is Cisco's father's occupation and where does he live?
He lives in New Orleans and he runs a restaurant.
Correct. What kind of restaurant?
It's a Cajun restaurant.
That's right.
Yeah.
All right. Number nine. Uh-huh. Name three characters who have been either a Vedic or a Kai.
Three characters. All right. Kai Wynn.
Mm-hmm.
Kai Opaka.
Mm-hmm.
And Vedic Burrell.
Burrell, but yeah, Burrell. Close enough. Yeah, Opaka was the one that I wasn't sure if you would remember. I also wondered if you were going to try to cheat and use Wynn as both a Vedic and a Kai.
You know, if I were grasping at straws, that's exactly what I'd do.
All right. Number 10.
Okay.
Why was Cassidy Yates sent to prison in season 4?
Because she was smuggling stuff for the Maquis.
That's right.
Yeah.
Very good. I think you got like 8.5.
I got like 9 out of 10.
That's pretty good.
Ooh, I did so good. I'm proud of myself now. So we're not going to talk about this week's shows because both of us are feeling a little bit under the weather. So we're going to cut this episode short and talk about our reflections next week. But having that said, if you would like to reach out to us, we are on Twitter at Smarts Podcast. On Facebook, it's facebook.com/smartspodcast. Our website is www.smartspodcast.com. And our email address is mailbag@smartspodcast.com. And here's a funny sound.